I'm not doing an introduction. I can't say all the bull about this and that and this and that. You don't have to say anything. All you say is the real thing, Eddie Amu. Do you know, it must be amazing, and I've always wanted to say this to you on air, it must be amazing to think, forget your talent, you have an anthem that will live forever. You to Me or Everything is an anthem that I play, I sing in karaoke, I play in the discos, and I've done it for years. Must be a wonderful feeling, that.
It is, actually. You know, I mean, sometimes because we're the sort of originators of it, we don't quite grasp what it means to so many people. You know what I mean? We don't grasp it until people come up to it and they say, on such and such a day, I done this, and your record was the background. I got engaged to so and so, and this is the record they played. Some people come up to us and actually, some they start sobbing. You know, it's really strange.
Eddie, if I start singing it in a club, straight away, and different age groups. That's what I love. Different age groups know the words.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing about the song, you know. Yeah.
That's a magical thing. Let's talk about the real thing. Let's go back 100 years to Radio Merseyside, and I had a group called Vocal Perfection sitting in my audience, sitting in my studio, and they sang Happy Birthday, and I've got it somewhere, the tape is there, but I can't find it.
You've got to dig it out, mate.
How many years ago is that?
Well, it's got to be at least 40 years, because we've been on the road 36 years as a sort of with an audience, you know, like as a hip band. And you know yourself, there was quite a few years struggling before then, when the group was called Vocal Perfection.
Well, Vocal Perfection, how did it change to the real thing? How did that happen?
Well, I think, I'm not sure whether it started off as a sophisticated Soul Brothers and went to Vocal Perfection, but Real Thing, I think, came up in late 1974, I'd say. The band were just about to perform on Opportunity Knocks. Tony Hall, our manager, needed a decent name for the band. And I know this sounds corny, but the band, we were driving through Piccadilly, and he looked up Coca-Cola, Real Thing.
Wow!
And basically, he just thought... Basically, as far as Tony was concerned, Christopher, even then, had a world-class voice. He was the Real Thing. Do you understand what I'm saying, yeah? And he thought that it just suited us, you know, at the time.
Over the years, Eddie, has it been a happy group? I mean, have you got on well? Because we hear all these stories about groups breaking up. I mean, let's dig the dirt. In general, has it worked?
The power of the group is the fact that me and Christopher are brothers. And you know that there are only three of us now. There were four, but that's because Ray sadly passed away in 1999. He left the group 9 years before, I think 8 years before then. He left in 1991. And apart from the problems we had with Ray, which really, as you get older, you realise it wasn't his fault, because sometimes we're born with baggage that we're never able to get rid of. And that was sort of like Ray's problem. He never was able to get rid of his baggage. And as we grew more successful, so his problems got worse, in fact, till in the end he had to leave, you know. Apart from that, we get on so well. You know, we get on so well. Obviously, me and Christopher are brothers, so that helps. But Dave, we've known... Well, to tell you the truth, I'm older, as you know, than Dave and Chris. And I remember Dave used to come up to the house with Chris when I was in the Chants. And I used to play them a card and cheat them and take them money and stuff like that, you know. I used to have such a laugh with them. So the chemistry has always been perfect for us, you know what I'm saying? They've been very, very... We don't have any of the sort of like ego trips and stuff like that a lot of bands suffer with. Me and Christopher are the writers. We've always set the direction, right? And it's always been accepted. So therefore, there's never been any problems. It's been quite enjoyable, you know, and that's the truth.
What was the height of Real Thing's career? What was the crowning glory? What was the, apart from some of the anthems you've left us, what was the most enjoyable part of the top?
I know that this is going to most probably sound a little bit strange, but in 1979 we were booked to work with the Jacksons at the Rainbow in London, and at the same time we were in the top five with Can You Feel the Force, yeah? And I will never forget that day as long as I live. Can You Feel the Force was literally screaming up the charts, and we met Michael and the rest of the guys. It was amazing, Peter. It was just a buzz. Because don't forget, man, we'd followed them since they sort of like took the world apart when they were kids. When Michael was mostly about 13 or something, you know. And sort of like meeting them was just, it was just a buzz, you know.
Did you have any photos of that?
No.
Oh,
crazy,
what?
Wasn't, we stupid? We should have got hold of them. But tell you the truth, they're very, very, very private, Peter. You didn't really feel as if you could take that liberty, if I could put it that way. They were very, very, very friendly, but distant. Do you understand what I'm saying, you know? Without being arrogant. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
When Michael Jackson died?
Pete, for me, it was a bad one, man. I was shocked. You know, and to my eternal shame, when they first started sort of like broadcasting the story, I thought it was just another one of the publicity stunts. I really did, man. I thought, he's coming to do the 02. He's coming to tour. Here we go. Do you know? And I couldn't believe it, man. I think it was round about like 10 o'clock at night or something like that. It flashed over on television. I was absolutely shocked because I'm telling you dead straight, there'll never be another artist like Michael Jackson. He had it all. He was a great writer. And he was also an absolutely amazing performer. And on top of that, he was also quite bizarre as well. He had everything going. I mean, he was strange, man.
I'm talking to Eddie Amu from The Real Thing. Do you get angry, you and Christopher, and the boys you know from the old days of music, do you get angry at what you're seeing that's happening to the music industry now?
In what way, Pete?
The programmes like X Factor. Because it's all very well them winning. They haven't got any backup. They haven't got... They don't know how to handle an audience. They don't know how to tour. They don't know any of that.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? I'm not knocking it because I think it's great. Any talent coming through. But you have to handle an audience.
Well, I do knock it, to tell you the truth, Peter. And I'll tell you why. I don't get angry. I get sad for the artist. Because from where I am, it's just mass exploitation. They're exploiting wannabes. You know yourself that 99% of the acts that appear on that show will disappear and never be seen again, right? Only the most talented, right? The most talented, and also the people who are lucky enough to have the right business people around them will survive. And I've seen very, very little of that. And okay, yeah. It must be enjoyable for them. I mean, do you understand what I'm saying? They must really enjoy it. But it, to me, it's on that line of exploitation is there for me.
Yeah, but that enjoyment stopping there, Eddie, the enjoyment is great. But once they've had a taste and they lose it, you know yourself, you've been very, very famous. You've had anthems. You're still there. I went to a stage that I became nearly very famous and it didn't happen. So we know that pain. And, you know, it is an ego, but it also is a pain. That's what we strive for. They have a taste of it, and they're just thrown in the gutter.
Taken away, yeah. And if they haven't got the mental capacity, look what they've got to live with. They've got to live with all the friends, most probably taking the mickey out of them and say, ha, 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 where are you now? You thought you was. All that type of stuff, you know? Yeah. I do, like I said in the beginning, didn't I? I can't help but feel a little bit sad for them, you know? Mm. Having said that, if I was a young artist coming in today, I'm not going to say that if I seen the chance was offered to me, I wouldn't take it. Do you understand what I'm saying, you know? But I'm not happy with the way the whole industry's gone. But then the whole industry's gone. The industry mirrors the way society's gone, Peter.
Well, I went to the Mobos, so I know what you mean. And I, for the first time ever, have said, I'm getting old. Because I didn't understand the music, I don't understand the speak, I don't understand where they're going with it, and I didn't recognise it. Oh, I saw Billy Ocean, that was it. JLS, just about. The rest were a blur to me, a total blur. Because music has moved on, hasn't it?
So maybe absolutely. I've got no problems with music moving on, you've got to move on with it. What I do have a problem with is attitudes. I don't think there's any need at all for nastiness, for cruelty, for the sort of like dehumanising of women and stuff like that that goes with it. I don't like the way it's encouraged. I think you can have great music, great rap, great lyricists. There are a lot of rappers who absolutely do the job, absolutely fantastic piece. But there are a lot of others who really do trade on violence and the sort of like the whole sort of like gangster thing, I don't like it myself.
Yeah. So you're still working. You're still out there.
Still out there, man. And enjoying it as well. Enjoying it, you know. I mean, sometimes, like, you know, when I climb on the bus, you know, to sort of like go to a gig, sometimes I scratch myself and think, Jesus Christ, how come I'm still doing this? This is it's too good to be true, you know. Particularly when you've done a fantastic show with your band, the band's kicking, the audience is sort of like are out there with you. You know, you're flying, Peter. You know what I'm saying? I think I appreciate it a lot more now than I did 40 years ago, tell you the truth.
Let's go back. The Chance. Now, there's a name from my past.
Mm-hmm.
Were they the only black group in Liverpool at the time?
No. The Chance weren't the only black group. You had acts like Steve Aldo, The In Crowd.
Of course. What am I talking about? Yes.
Shuffler Sound. Little teeny bit later on, but still all around about the same time, the Wentons and stuff like that. There were a lot
this
of sorts of...
in the Merseybeat D, in the Merseybeat
yeah.
Days.
Oh, yeah. Geddy Wilkie. Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of, like, really good black acts, but I think where the Chance scored is, like, we were totally different. We were totally unique in the fact that we were a five-piece, or this is how we started off anyway. Absolutely. And that. But we were a five-piece a cappella singing group, which was totally unknown here. Which is basically why, I mean, everybody knows the story. The Beatles heard us. The Beatles sort of like invited us down to the cavern to go on stage with them. And they sort of like backed us for four tunes. I mean, the story's been told so many times. I can't believe that we never got any footage of that, Peter. Can you imagine what that would be worth? Do you understand what I'm saying? Can you just imagine it, you know? But that's life. When you're an 18-year-old kid, you don't actually think about things like that. But
and nobody knew the Beatles would ever be that big.
Absolutely.
Nobody in the world could ever
absolutely
said that would have happened.
Absolutely, man.
Did you enjoy the Merseybeat days?
Pete, it was like walking through a looking glass. It was like Alice in Wonderland, you know. You've got to remember that growing up in Toxteth in them days, your world was Parliament Street, Granby Street, right? Parliament Street, Granby Street, Hill Street. And you never actually moved out of that triangle. Right? So, all of a sudden now, we step into this world of Merseybeat where all these bands are playing. They're playing the songs that we've dug for years, like the Coasters and, you know, people like that. And it's live and it's vibrant. It was just amazing. It was amazing, man. It was like stepping into a completely new world for us. It opened my eyes completely because for the first time as well, I seen how a lot of people lived outside of Toxteth, you know, which I'd never seen.
Eddie,
you know
what
I mean?
What was racism back like in those days with when the Chance were there?
You see, this is a hard question to answer, right? And I'll try and answer it without the proverbial chip on one shoulder. You and I both know that racism has always existed in Liverpool. It's existed everywhere.
And still does.
Yeah, still does, right? As far as the Chance were concerned, everybody loved the band. It was only when the band tried to make that breakout into the big time that we started to hit the walls. And I don't know whether it was because we were black or because they simply didn't know what to do with us.
Interesting.
Do you know what I'm saying? I don't. I'd have to sit in front of you, Pete, and say I just didn't know because I've got to say that the Chance were given every chance to make it. We got all the big TV shows. We had write-ups in all the big papers. We were played on the radio. But people just didn't seem to know how to promote us. And what's more important, we didn't know anything about markets or anything like that. You know, we just went into the studio and made a record, and expected it to go on the chart, you know what I mean? It wasn't like that. The music business has never been like that. The real thing had a mentor. The Chance didn't.
Right.
The Chance didn't.
So no one was guiding you?
Nobody was guiding us. People managed us and stuff like that. But they just didn't know. I mean, I've always written songs, for instance. I mean, I wrote the Chance first single stuff. But I just used to think, oh, write a good song. It's going to be a hit. It's nothing like that. It doesn't work like that. You've got to have a market. You've got to know what you're writing for and stuff. So I would say it was part racism maybe and part bad business. But to just put my hand up and say we didn't make it just because we were black, that would be telling lies, Pete. That would be a big lie.
What happened to the chance?
The chance run the course where the first big explosion, right? After a few years, you improve, you get better and better and better, but you lose that sort of like, you use that magic, you lose that sort of like, that wide-eyed sort of like thing that audiences pick up on. And although we worked and we always worked regularly, you know that, because we used to do the Shakespeare, we used to do all them places, but somewhere along the way, the magic slipped away and we became a journeyman band. That's basically what happened, really. But, having said that, the chance were my apprenticeship. Everything I learned about music, I learned while I was in the chance. And then when my break came, I was able to put it to good use, you know what I'm saying? Everything I learned.
You, Jerry Marsden, The Searchers, continually tour.
Mm.
What is it? Do you just love it?
Because we... Basically, yeah, you've got it there. We all love what we're doing, you know? I mean, it's years and years since I've seen Jerry, years since I've seen The Searchers, because we all do different type gigs. We're always touring, and we're on different circuits. But basically, I just think you've got to have that thing. It's that thing that makes you want to go out and you've got it yourself, Pete. You're not just doing it to take money and earn a living. You're doing it because you love doing it, and you get that spark when you're on stage. That's what keeps us going. Because otherwise, quite frankly, there are easier ways to earn a living.
Do you get disappointed that there's no records out anymore that you've got because you've written such great records and the music industry's changed? Does it annoy you?
No, because I know that when the time's right, we'll come again, right? I mean, look, we could release a record every month if we wanted to, but nobody listens and it's not going to get played. So, therefore, you've got to wait for your chance, wait for your niche, and be ready. But you never, ever lose your dreams.
Interesting. What do you say to young singer, songwriters, musicians, drummers out there who want it? It's a different world now. We have these social
internet
networking. We've got this where they put their own music on. What do you say? What advice do you give? As somebody who's been in the industry and has had a lot of knocks and a lot of highs, what do you say to them?
To new people coming in? First of all, above all things, develop a thick skin. That's number one. You must have a thick skin. And remember, for every person that likes your music, there's somebody else that won't like it. And you have to accept that. Number two, use what's around you to the best of your ability, right? Number three, don't make money the main sort of impetus of what you're trying to aim at. Enjoy what you're doing and get good at it, and success, if it's going to come, will come. There are no rules in this business, no rules, so nobody can guarantee anything. But that's also the magic thing about this business, because every week is different, and that's the magic thing about it.